Right, the subject they said was given to various creatures, but the last subject we had a guy that started with a very, very poor background, certainly didn't start from strength and a legitimate child, and yet God was able to use him. I dare say this is the great message of the book of Judges, that despite my failures, God loves to use even me. And that's an exciting thing to know, that failure is not final with God, as is often put. So let's open the scriptures to the next judge that we look at together, and it's in Judges chapter 13. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, so the Lord delivered them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. We've got this familiar pattern that's happened again. There was a deliverer raised up, and then there was a recession, a landslide, and then finally there was a supplication to God, and God provided a deliverer. I wonder how we live the Christian life. I wonder if we live the Christian life on the basis of the contract system with God, or on the basis of the battery system. There's two ways of getting power. One is on a battery system, and there needs to be a constant recharge. And often folk live their Christian lives that way. They go along to a camp, a conference, and there's another charge for a short time. You know, I believe that that's rather a wasteful way of living the Christian life. I'm convinced that the way to live the Christian life is through the contact system. The trains of Sydney live on the contact system. They're in touch with all of the power of Sydney. And it taps into the coal fields to the west and the coal fields to the north. And God is open for us to live in the contact system. And yet so often we just have a storage mentality. We go along, we get a boost. The battery, the power that we seem to get runs down, and we need another charge. And I just feel very, very convinced that we need to have a contact system that we build up with God. The people of Israel didn't have that. And it's great to know that the eyes of the Lord were on his people. That can either be a dreadful thing or it can be a delightful thing, that God is looking on his people. It depends on our relationship with him. Well, he has a tremendous start in life, this he-man with a she-weakness. Each act in his life centres about a woman, and only one of them had a really positive influence on his life. Compared to Jephthah, he started very, very well, and let's see just the start that he did have in life. So in verse 2, we begin the first act. A certain man of Zorah named Manoah from the clan of the Danites had a wife who was sterile and remained childless. Don't know if that's the usual thing. If someone's to blame, always blame the wife, but it appears that the reason was that the wife was sterile and remained childless. I just wonder. In the light of some of the things that we have had so far this weekend, I don't believe that that casts any doubt on Scripture, but that's the way it appeared to be. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and said, "You're sterile and childless, but you're going to conceive and have a son. Now see to it that you drink no wine or other fermented drink, and that you do not eat anything unclean, because you will conceive and give birth to a son. No razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth. And he will begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines." The great thing that Samson had going for him was that he had godly parents. They knew what it was to pray. They knew what it was to receive guidelines from God before he was born. And when they had a problem, they brought it to God. And there was a problem. She was sterile. And so one day an angel appeared and gave them some indications, gave her some indications as what was going to happen. And a good thing happened. There was no inconsistency with the parents in this particular aspect of life. They put into practice the fact that she was not going to drink wine or drink any of the products of the vine, and it was going to be a family where mum and dad practiced and demonstrated what godliness was all about. I had someone drawn to my attention last week that's been deeply stumbled. The parents are objecting about the 21-year-old's drinking habits, and yet quite often the 21-year-old comes home and find that mum and dad have been indulging. And they usually cover it up, rationalise it with the fact, well, we've just been entertaining visitors. But here we've got a family that's united, and mum and dad seem to have given a decent model to the kids. And so way before the birth of the child, mum follows what she's heard from the angel, as God's messenger. And I could talk a little bit about no razor being used on his head. Yes, I could talk about saving a year of his life, but I won't go off into that one. He was a Nazarite set apart to God from birth. And Tom Carson yesterday pointed out to us that he was the one that was going to begin the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines. There was going to be a partial involvement in his life. He wasn't going to be the complete deliverer. You know, I dread this particular thing of not completing the work that God has given me to do. I believe that God has a plan for my life. I believe that he has a plan for your life. I wonder if we're surely falling short of the plan that he has. The life of Samson is one of falling short. Tremendous natural ability, and yet he fell so far short. He just began to do the work that God had given to him. It was a kind of a partial thing. I think of the words in the New Testament, Colossians 4:18, tell Archippus, see to it, you complete, you fulfill the work you have received in the Lord. Has God's plan been fulfilled in your life and in mine? And so here is a person that most of his life is fairly sad as we think of what he could have been if he'd have cultivated that approach to God of the contact system. If he'd known what it was to face up to his weaknesses. His weaknesses with the opposite sex, I believe that his life could have been such a blessing to so many people. And yet the opinion and the impression that I've got from Samson is that at the end of his life, it's very, very hard to work out. Just where he went, and he didn't seem to have very great impact on any followers. There was no one seemed to following him personally. He didn't leave anyone to take up the reins. And anything he did was himself, and that seemed to be on an on-off system. And so it's sad to see that he was the one that began the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines. No doubt there were others that did take it up later on. But it seems to be that his life just fell so far short of what it could have been. One of the things I take my students around the grounds to see as soon after they arrive in one of our subjects, personal spiritual development. There's a poor old tree down in the backyard, and there's a whole lot of pine trees, and they're all as high as the ceiling or higher, and there's one poor old tree that gets knocked by every new car that comes to Emmaus, and the poor old thing is just as knobbly as can be, and there it is, about 5 feet high, and as spindly as a pine tree could be, and it just gets knocked every year, and it just seems to never be able to grow. Its mates are so far ahead, and it's sad to just see a tree that hasn't reached its potential. And it's sadder to see a Christian that has not reached their potential. The potential naturally, their potential as far as talents are concerned, and potential as far as spiritual gifts are concerned too. All right, let's go on and look a little bit more at the parents and see what happened. The lady had the vision from God about what was going to happen, and she shared that with hubby in verse 6, and they have a bit of a discussion, and she doesn't seem to know who it was or where he came from, and I wonder if there wasn't a little bit of scolding that went on between them. She tells very clearly that the child is to be a Nazarite, and she is setting the example. The next scene is set in verse 8. Then Manoah prayed to the Lord, O Lord, I beg you, let the man of God you sent to us come again to teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born. Beautiful prayer, isn't it? And here it is. It seems to have a tremendous, not our Father that art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. It's nothing like that, isn't it? O Lord, I beg you, let the man of God you sent come to teach us. And the thing that hit me was the little word us. Here's a mum and dad. They've been promised a child after many years of childlessness in their marriage. Teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born. That really sort of says something to me. It's a bit late in my family. One grandchild now, but teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born. Some of you have wives that are expecting. I wonder if that's what your prayer is. I wonder if you equally take on the responsibility for training the child, of working out a code of discipline so the child is secure. Teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born. That's as practical as can be, isn't it? All right, God heard Manoah, and so the scene changes again. And there's another chance, along comes the angel again, and so we'll skip down to verse 12. They've already prayed, teach us how to bring up the boy who is to be born, and then Manoah's anxious to get his word into the angel, the heavenly visitor. And so in verse 12 he says, when your words are fulfilled, what is to be the rule for the boy's life and work? Give us some guidelines. And that's a great thing. It's a tremendous thing for a child to come up with the security of parents that have worked out guidelines for raising that child. Guidelines as to discipline, guidelines as to spiritual training, guidelines as to what's important in life. And so it's just great to see that lesson there for us. What's to be the rule for the boy's life and work? If you raise your family, what guidelines have you got for the raising of the children? Do you discipline in anger? What do you try to teach the child? Are you sincere in what you're trying to teach the child, or are there inconsistencies? You say one thing and do another. And so it's very, very simple. What's to be the rule for the boy's life and work? It's a great attitude to have. Lord, may we have rules, may we have guidelines to raise our kids by. Verse 13, the angel of the Lord answered, your wife must do all that I told her. So once more, I think we're getting the message that obedience is absolutely essential. Obedience to act on what God says. Three S's that I dread, and they are sit, soak and sour. Often I put them on the blackboard at Emmaus. And I dread the thought of people just not doing what the Word of God says. Sitting, soaking and sour. And here your wife must do all that I've told her. She must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine. And so there's a reiteration of the negative points. She must do everything I have commanded you. And so the story goes on a little bit further. And Manoah inquires in verse 17 of the angel of the Lord, what's your name so that we may honour you when your word comes true? And the angel doesn't receive that honour and says, make a sacrifice to the Lord. Manoah gets scared and said, okay, we're going to die in verse 22 because we've seen the Lord. And the wife says, no, that's not true. He's accepted the offering that we've given, and so he will not kill us at all. The early life of Samson is just summarized in perhaps about 26 words. In verse 24, the woman gave birth to a boy and named him Samson. He grew and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him while he was in Mahanah, Dan between Zorah and Eshtahol. So here we've got a young man that has a godly example. He has a model to live by. He's been given guidelines to live by his godly parents. And that's a tremendous thing. But again, there needs to be the exercise of the will. There must be the individual response in the life of the child. And one thing I suppose that this story illustrates is that sensual children can be born to spiritual parents. And that puts us on our mettle all the more, doesn't it? In raising children, we certainly need guidelines. We certainly need to be on our knees before God. It needs not to be just the wife's approach. You know, the sad thing in Australian Christianity is that the wife does most of the spiritual training. And I believe that that's a sad thing. Samuel had the godly example of both parents. And here he is blessed by God as a youth, and the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him, or to drive him hard. Reminds me very much of the language of the Lord as he was driven into the desert. But there was a purpose that God had for the life of this young man by the name of Samson. So he had a tremendous background. He had a tremendous start in life. But there are other acts in his life. Let's go through and have a look at some of the other acts in the life of Samson. Well, we come to him and his wife and how he got her. And this is rather tragic. Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, "I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah, now get her for me as my wife." I get into trouble when I do the actions for this little bit, but there's a whole lot of actions that can go by it. There's a whole lot of body language that can go with it too. I'm sure it wasn't said as blandly as I said it. But he went down, and he is ruled by his eyes. He saw there a young Philistine woman, and he reiterates that when he comes back, "I've seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Get her for me as my wife." Further down in the chapter, as mum and dad go through the usual things that happen when a child announces that they're pretty serious with someone of the opposite sex, usually there is a blown fuse somewhere, or there is a mumble and a withdrawal. Often the man is the mumbler and the withdrawing one. And I expect that was similar in the experience here. And they protest. They said, "Listen, isn't there someone here close? Someone amongst the Jews that you must go outside and get a wife." But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, she's the right one for me." And he was adamant. And it's very, very sad to see a person that started so well. And the Spirit wants to do so much in their life. And here there's a block. There is a tragedy around the corner in the person that person is thinking of marrying. And so Samson is ruled by his sight, and that is one of the most powerful things that rules us men, is our eyes. The eyes, our wives can't understand how we can be ruled and dominated by our eyes as far as our sexuality is concerned. They are much more turned on by touch and by kind words. But one of the driving forces in a man's life as far as his sexuality is concerned is what he does with what he sees, and especially the opposite sex. You know, I believe some firm decisions must be made, and they must be carried out through life if we're not going to fail in this direction. It's pretty hard not to be affected as we go to the beach these days, isn't it? You can make a decision to walk into the surf down on the wet side of the beach as you go out to Soldier's Point. Or you can go down and you can sort of have a look at what's going on in the Sandhills region. Each of us has a natural desire and a natural attraction and a natural pulling towards the Sandhills. I do believe that we overcome that by what we decide. It's a decision that we make. And to me, it's a very, very important thing that we just don't sort of put ourselves into temptation, but that we are aware of where temptation comes from, and that we actively go about to flee youthful lusts, to flee the desire and the pull of what we see and the messages that gives to our brain. And so Samson is a man that's dictated by his eyes, what he sees. The Lord has something very, very powerful to say about this. And he says, look, if your eye causes you to sin or to stumble, pluck it out. Hey, everyone's got eyes in their head here today. What have we been doing? Certainly that's not to be applied literally. I've heard people that do sort of apply it literally, but I'm sure that it's certainly not to be applied that way. But the Lord just gives that to a male. He says, look, I tell you that if anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. What does that mean? I believe it means to give a wide berth to when you find that you're taking the next step. Not just a glance. All males are attracted to females. Okay? But the next thing is what you do with that attraction. What you do in the next step. And that's where the simple part can take over. It's when a person goes through fantasy. And when there's an undressing, and when there's going further in the mind, the word is lusting after. It's not just lusting even. It's lusting after. It's going the next step of fantasizing, of going through the motions towards full sexual involvement with that person. I know this verse has tormented many men, and many people have given up Christianity because of the fact that they cannot overcome lust. The verse talks about lusting after. It's pressing on. It's hunting the thing down. It's taking a step further than just a casual glance, or just an attraction, or just an admiration. And so in the life of Samson, he's a person that didn't heed that. I was still, when I was back in New Guinea last time, to be just reading through the book of Job. And I didn't know that one of the most ancient books in the world had something very, very powerful to say on this particular subject. And back in Job chapter 31 and verse 1, I think it is, Job has these words to say, "I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. For what is man's lot from God above, his heritage from the Almighty on high." One of the oldest books in the Bible. And here we have a man of God, Job, who came to grips with this. He made a covenant with his eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. All right, I believe that that is something that we need to do in a very, very conscious sort of way. It's the eyes and it's the thinking that are the basic issues involved in the area of involvement in a wrong way with the opposite sex. We'll trace that through a little bit further in a minute. His parents did not know that this was from the Lord. Don't we get one of these mysteries that have hovered over the whole book of Judges? How can God sort of work in the situation of something that's wrong? It's an amazing thing that God is over all, God blessed for all forever. That somehow that God even sort of has a pattern that he's working out, even though Christians fail him and Christians fall. And so this was from the Lord. I believe that the whole program was from the Lord, that the Philistines were going to be defeated. And so this is a fit in parenthesis. Who was seeking an occasion to confront the Philistines? God was looking for a man. God was looking for an occasion to confront the Philistines. And it's amazing how he even uses Samson. A man that sort of is so powerful that it's hard for God to use him. We run into two areas of difficulty. If we're too weak and we put ourselves down, then we don't allow God to use us. We become so inferior that we just block God in using us. If we become too almighty, too proud, we block God in using us. We are to think of ourselves in an honest sort of way, realizing we have weaknesses and realizing that we have strengths, allowing God to work on the weaknesses and dedicating our strengths to God himself. All right, so here it is. He's on the downward path and he's been ruled by his eyes. And so the next chapter is that mum and dad comply. And so we see the next scene where they are moving down towards making arrangements for the wedding in verse 5. And as they come near to Timnah, there's a young lion and it comes roaring towards them. And here we see the first demonstration of the Spirit of the Lord coming on Samson. I think we've explained that adequately. The Spirit of the Lord comes on for a purpose in the Old Testament, for an event. There's not that constancy, that constant indwelling as you get into the New Testament. And so under the power of the Spirit of God, he tears the line apart. And that is the next step downhill, we can say, because he comes back and he gets hold of the honey and he just gives that around. He breaks his Nazarite vow as sometime later he comes back and on the way to the wedding and he picks out the honey and gives it to his parents. And he has little regard for the spiritual things of life. He's taken up with his own natural desires for a woman, for honey, for water, and the things that are just external are the things that really grab hold of our friend Samson. All right, verse 7, he went down, talked with a woman, and he liked her. Everything just seems to be natural, just doing what comes natural. And of course, that is something that gets us into a whole lot of trouble. You know, Satan has a 1-2 card trick. He has the fool's mate in chess. And so often, if he can't get a person hooked up, a spiritual giant with an unbeliever, then he gets a spiritual giant hooked up with a pygmy Christian. A person that's going to just pull that person down, that Scrooge of God, in every way. And I believe that we need to be aware of this. So often people counsel the opposite sex, and they find that all sorts of attractions build up in the counselling, the intimacy of counselling. And it's one of Satan's one-two card trick. It's the fool's mate. And so often there's a warmth and there's an attraction that builds up. And there's a transference. My husband is an awful drunkard. And here's someone that just sort of is understanding me for the first time in my life. And it's amazing how Satan's used that in the past, and he continues to use it. And the rule is that we should be very, very careful in counselling members of the opposite sex. My rule is once or twice, and then I get hold of my wife, and she's involved from then on, or we're involved together. The other rule is, as soon as you find that you start to fantasize, as soon as you start to find that you're involved in your mind more than you want to be, it's the time to drop the counselling straight away at that point of time. Satan doesn't use perhaps the outward sort of approaches, but he's a master at the cunning approach and the subtle approach. And so the key note is not so much the outward physical attraction and hopping to bed. It's not so much that, but someone said, Smedley, I think it is, says this: I'm convinced that more people get themselves into the pain of infidelity through empathy, concern, and compassion than through any base motive. It's an amazing statement, and yet it's very, very true. We expect a calendar or a person scantily clad or something coming across our paths like that to just sort of make us fall. And we are not on our guard to the little things and to the good things, apparently good things, of empathising with someone in trouble, showing concern and showing compassion. How does it all happen? Let's go over to the New Testament again before we go on a little further in the life of Samson. Over into James. James really sort of gives us some insights into what we do with temptation. First of all, he tells us what temptation is. And then he tells us what testing is, or testing and then temptation. And down in verse 13, he comes into a description of what temptation is. And it says, when tempted. Temptation is inevitable. It's not if tempted, it's when we are tempted. It's inevitable in life that we go through much temptation in our Christian life. And so James is a realist, and he says, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. God never tempts to get a person to fall down. He certainly tests, but he never tempts. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone, but each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. Each one is tempted. By his own evil desire. And there's an emphasis on the fact that it's me. I must face up to my part in temptation. I can reject temptation or I can play with it. I can fondle it. I can flirt with it. Or I can flee from it. And I believe as men of God, men that want to go somewhere with God in their lives, that we need to make that decision. What are we going to do? Especially in this area of sexual temptation. James then goes on to talk in the terms of fishing. And he talks of the fact of the enticing process, the bait dropped. And then, of course, we have our own evil desire that responds very, very much to that sort of thing. And so the first thing is we look and we start swimming towards the thing that is obviously attractive to us for a little time. But it's got a hook in it. Then after desire has conceived, he changes the metaphor a little bit and he talks about conceiving. He talks about the fact of swimming towards the bait and then playing around with the bait and eventually swimming off with the bait. And at that time, that person, the desire has conceived. We've taken the bait. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth. And so there's a conception. And then there's a giving birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. There's nothing as devastating a person as to cast away for God. And I know of no other way, the old 1-2 card trick that the devil uses so often, to just nullify and negate our ministry, is to just get us into that death situation where sin.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
And I know of no other way, the old 1-2 card trick the devil uses so often, to just nullify and negate our ministry, is to just get us into that death situation where sin is conceived and it becomes a habitual thing. And then it just explodes into the open. It's tremendous just to realise that God knows the way and God has given us the outline where sin goes. And it's great to just know some of the ways that Satan uses to tempt us and to get us to just to fall. I love the way Swindoll refers to this. He says this very, very honestly in his book, Three Steps Forward and Two Steps Back. I was in Canada months ago. I had been away from home 8 days. And there were 2 more to go, a weekend. I was lonely and having a pity party for myself at supper. Alone, I bought a newspaper, thumbed through the sports section, and found nothing but hockey, the favourite of Canadians, but not mine. I heaved a sigh and walked towards the elevator. En route, I heard a couple of young women talking and laughing as they used the hotel phone in the lobby. I smiled as I passed by, and a few steps later punched the up elevator button. I got in, so did the 2 ladies. I punched 6. They didn't reach for the row of buttons. So I asked what floor. One looked at me rather sensually and said, "How about 6? Do you have any plans?" We were all alone in an elevator in Canada. I was flattered, to be honest, since most folks don't usually mistake me for Robert Redford or James Garner. These women were available, and I was lonely. On that trip from the lobby to the 6th floor, I had an extremely significant decision to make. The bait had been dropped. Do you know what immediately flashed into my mind? My wife and 4 children? No, not at first. My position and reputation? No, not then. The possibility of being seen or set up? No. God gave me an instant visual replay of Galatians 6 and 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. And Ephesians 6:11, put on the full armour of God, that you may be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And Romans 6:11-12, even so consider yourselves to be dead to sin, but alive to God in Jesus Christ. Therefore do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey its lusts. During that elevator lift, the memorized word that flew to my rescue right on time. As I look back at the 2, I replied, "I've got a full evening planned already. I'm really not interested." They looked at me like I was Mork from Ork as I stepped off the elevator. And they stayed on. I walked to my room, suddenly grateful for the overcoming power of God's book. As I write these words to you, I'm filled with renewed strength because His word has kept me faithful again and again for 25 years of marriage. Yes, the memorized word of God works. Are we storing the word of God in our minds? Are we making those decisions? Decisions as far as our faithfulness is concerned. Our faithfulness to God and our faithfulness to our loved ones. I dare say Joseph comes to mind, and I can usually not preach on this bit in Judges without mentioning the incident of Joseph and his life. And we all know how that he was tempted by Potiphar. What was the key to success of overcoming that? A guy that was right at the height of his sexual prowess, and here he was alone. The boss is away, and there's a woman that's not being very subtle. And she just doesn't sort of go in for subtleties, but she's noticed his physique, she's noticed how handsome he is, and so she's given him the come on, she's given him the green light, and what does he do? She took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me," but he refused. He refused on the basis of 2 things. He says, "Loyalty to Potiphar. He's given me charge of everything except you as his wife." And secondly, loyalty to God. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. Brethren, I believe that that's the answer. Or even be with her. As I speak to a group of men, I believe that many of us are having flirting sessions that we're involved in some little attention that we've given to the opposite sex. Joseph was meant business with God. He refused to even be with her. He didn't sort of draw the line with a cuddle and a kiss. He refused to even be with her. It was no wonder that he went through a tremendous amount of sadness as she framed him. The so-called love soon turned to hate, and God gave him success, though, in everything he did. Let's get back to the book of Judges. I do believe that what we do with the opposite sex, I believe that the partner that we choose in life is a vital decision, the second most important decision that we'll make in life. I believe that tonight we should be sort of working through what are we going to do with fidelity and infidelity. Another writer, Scores, talked about the seasons of marriage, Norman Wright, and he talks about the open season, affairs and unfaithfulness. Let's go on a little bit further in the life of Samson. His eyes have been exercised with no restraint. He's hooking himself up to a heathen woman, contrary to God's law. He has gone and he's broken his Nazarite vow as far as the lion's carcass touching a dead thing is concerned. And he's going downhill rapidly. He goes on a little bit further, and as the wedding proceeds, it's a 7-day affair. Sometimes I think 7 hours is a tremendously long sort of thing in our society, but this is a 7-day affair. And there's 30 best men, or 30 groomsmen, if you like. And I don't know who would normally provide the clothes. I know it's a tremendous cost in our society today. But here is Samson, and he's thinking of this, and as he thinks of the line, he works out a riddle. And puts it to the men. We all know the story. Maybe he was guided by covetousness, $3,000, maybe $6,000, $100 a suit in today's world. And so he's looking forward to a wardrobe full of clothes as he gives them the riddle. We know the story how that she manipulated him. Very, very difficult thing to know how to deal with a woman's tears in life, isn't it? Genuine tears, tears of manipulation. What's the cause of tears? And so we've got his wife here, and she's sobbing her heart out. She does it day after day. You don't love my people. You don't love me. He said, look, I haven't even told my mum and dad. And you can just imagine how things are getting a little bit sharp at that stage. And so she cries the whole 7 days of the feast. It's a pretty rough sort of wedding breakfast, isn't it? And then eventually they plough with his heifer. That's putting it in a strange sort of way, isn't it? And then, of course, as they plough with his heifer, out comes the answer. And he is hopping mad. He's burning with anger down in verse 19. And the strange thing is, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power. And he goes down to the coast, 23 miles, 40 kilometres. And he's hopping mad as he goes down to Ashkelon along the coast. And he kills some of the folk down there. And he brings back the 300 changes of clothing. I don't know whether he explained away the blood on some of the garments. Maybe he had the old thing, tomato sauce, but there it was. He came back burning with anger, and off he goes up to Dad's house. Certainly been a tragic chapter in his life, hasn't it? And as he just sort of fails to realise the importance of the things of God, and he's certainly going downhill. Often I say to young people, sometimes I bring a funnel up with me and I say, look, the way of the world is going into a funnel, and you go in the top end. And it's very, very open. There's no restrictions in the world around about us. It's a permissive society. Do your own thing. Sleep around. Do what you want to. As long as it's done with the spirit of love. But the thing is that it comes into a narrow confine. The broad way. And if you look at people that have lived that way, when they're 50 and when they're 60, when they're 40s, it's a constricted way. The Christian life starts the other way around. It starts with a narrow way, but it's a narrow way that as we follow God's way, in the areas of marriage, in the area of courtship, we come up into God's beautiful way of living. He doesn't want to spoil our fun. He wants to enrich our lives in every way. And so we've got a man by the name of Samson, and he is just going downhill, and he's hopping mad at the end of the second act in his life. Hooked up to the wrong person, and angry, breaking his vow with God, and it's not very rosy, his life at all. Well, let's go on to the next act in his life. Verse 20, and Samson's wife was given to the friend who had attended him at the wedding. That almost seems a bit of background, and then we see Samson introduced as he comes down at the time of the wheat harvest. Maybe he's gone up to dad and mum to pay his final respects, and as he comes down to pick up his wife, tragedy is already struck. Samson took a young goat and went to visit his wife. Imagine him there, sort of all wide-eyed and bushy-tailed as he's going down with the first lovely fattened young goat. And when he gets to the dad-in-law's place, where are you going? I'm going to my wife's room. But the father would not let him go in. Imagine him sort of stepping in the way, and there's this great big thundering guy by the name of Samson towering over him. And okay, the fat can be in the fire. The last we saw of him was he's angry and he's just killed 300 Philistines. And so in verse 2, I was so sure you thoroughly hated her, he said, that I gave it to your friend. Isn't a younger sister more attractive? Take her instead. Play with the world around, play hard and fast, and you reap what you sow. That's what we've had tonight, haven't we? You reap what you sow. And here he is. He's been playing around with the enemies of God's people, and he's reaping the results. The tragedy of the girl that he loved, his first love perhaps, and here she is, just palmed off to one of his, possibly his best man, and the sister has just been palmed off to him in a very casual sort of way. And so he is reaping the way of going down, the way of living without reference to God, the way of living just by the near natural element of life, living carnally rather than living spiritually. Well, the next thing is an exciting sort of thing as he goes out. I don't know how he got these 300 pairs of foxes. Some people say they're jackals. I don't know where he put the squalling things, but down that where Timnah, there are some tremendous limestone caves, and I suggest that he got them, and there, and when he got the whole lot, 300 pairs of foxes or jackals. And man, what a sight. Guy Fawkes' knife has nothing on it, and it's the ripened wheat season, and there's a fastened torch. I hope there are no RSPCA inspectors around, and it doesn't appear that there were, and there they are. They come out of that cave at 100 miles an hour. I've seen dogs with a can on their tail. They go pretty fast. To put two together, it must be the ultimate. They lit the torches and let the fox loose and the standing grain of the Philistines. He burned up the shocks and standing grain together with the vineyards and old olive groves. Man, the olive groves with all that oil in them, did they go up? And he's standing watching this. And he says, "Oh, teacher, old man, to do the dirty on me." And then the news comes out, "Hey, who did this?" And someone soon says, "Okay, Samson's father-in-law, he has a finger in it." And Samson turns around and he says, one of the pairs of jackals or foxes got into the village. But then he tweets, "Hey, no, it's not that." And he realises what's happened, that there's a spiteful revenge on his father-in-law and his wife, and they've been cooked alive in the house. And that sort of gets hold of him, and he just goes Burko at that stage, and he just attacks and revenge. He attacks them hip and thigh. I don't know what that means exactly in the authorised versions, but viciously, and slaughtered many of them. And then he goes down and lives in a cave for a while. I think it's a good place to be, Samson, down to think it through a little bit. And so he's down at Etham, and eventually along come the Philistines, and they're camped against his crowd, and unfortunately his crowd grab hold of him, and he is given over to them. And he appeals to them not to kill him. And once more, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him in power, down in verse 14. I can't understand that fully. It's an amazing thing how the grace of God does come to a person that that doesn't deserve the power of God for that moment. It's amazing how God comes in and answers prayer in personal and physical things. And so as the Spirit of God comes upon him, he just rips off the new ropes and man, no bike chain around, nothing like that. I wouldn't like to see him in the Father's Day Massacre out in the south of Sydney, but he finds a fresh jawbone of a donkey. I think that would have been more formidable than a bike chain or a knuckle duster. And man, does he go burko with this jawbone. 1,000 men. It's an amazing sort of thing to see what he does. And he does a little bit of poetry here, not to be outdone by some of the other poems in the book. With a donkey's jawbone I've made donkeys of them. With a donkey's jawbone I've killed 1,000 men. And then he just throws the thing away. Once more we see him just sort of living, not in regard to God, no thanksgiving, no, it's just the Lord's way for me to go. Once more he's sort of saying, I'm thirsty. Very, very unusual prayer he makes to God in verse 18. You've given your servant this great victory. Must I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised? Then God opened up the hollow place in Lehi and water came out of it. When Samson drank, his strength returned and he revived. So the spring was called En Hakhor, the cry of spring, and is still there in Lehi. Samson led Israel for 20 years in the days of the Philistines. I take it that was when he lived by faith. Most of the other public things that he seems to do in a very individualistic way seem to be where he just lives by sight. But a most unusual prayer. And it's tremendous to know that God is just so faithfully listening to our prayer. I heard today in our group of someone that a wife that used to pray for a parking spot, and a parking spot in the shade, and God answered her requests. It's an amazing thing to bring God in on the things of life. But do we just keep it when we're in a spot and just in request to do with our physical needs? And so he led Israel for 20 years in the day of the Philistines. Well, he goes back into his old sport, into women hunting after that. So Acts 3, we've just got in about four verses. One day Samson went to Gaza where he saw a prostitute, and his eyes continued to get him into trouble. May we learn that lesson indelibly. That if we want to have a marriage that is a marriage that where God is honoured, and we don't bring that heartbreak to our loved ones and our children and our family, a divorce affects 40 people at least. And for people that are prominent, they influence many, many more. And here, these are some of the recipes. To beware of the eyes, to beware of the thoughts, what we do. Beware of the fantasies that can so easily dwell up if we allow them an inch into our mind. And so we find that he's now seeing a prostitute, and the whole town gather around, and they said, all right, we'll get him out in the morning time. In morning we'll flush him out. And so we find that Samson gets up in the night, and in the middle of the night, I don't know if it was conscience that drove him, But he grabs hold of the doors, the city gates, and he's mad as a meat axe again, and 38 miles away, 60 kilometres away, right up near Hebron, you've got the gates of the town. The town of Gaza, right down in the far southwest corner, and they end up right in the highlands, 3,000 feet above sea level. It's an amazing sort of story as he just cuts these the doors of the city up. The sensuality was dormant, but it wasn't dead. In my counselling with people, I find that people have tremendous problems in the area of their sexual drive, their sexuality, in the teens and in the 40s. What happens in between? My sexuality is maybe dormant, but it certainly is not dead. Often there are a whole lot of other factors that come to bear in the 20s and 30s. But those are some of the decades that we need to watch most, the teens and in our 40s. And then the final woman that he came to court and to woo is sometime later in verse 4, the final act in his life, he fell in love. I take it was erotic love with a woman in the Valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. And she's the one that lured him. lured him for money, and so once more he made a bad choice as far as a woman was concerned. Often thought to be a Jewess by the meaning of a name and the fact that it is a Jewish name. And I think we all know how his strength left him. And he did not know that the Lord had left him. A very, very sad event as he comes to the end of his life. But he wasn't aware that the power of God had left him. I believe that he was under a false impression all the life, his life. He thought it was in his beard and in his hair. But it was the Lord that gave him that strength. It was the symbols of that were his long hair and his long beard. And so we find that he just is unaware. And that's very, very sad when we are unaware that the Lord has left our meetings, has left our circles. Is not present himself vitally, is not dwelling, he's not at home. We are grieving the Spirit of God. And so the end of the story is that his eyes are gouged out. And just then as his hair grows again, there's a mighty shout as he's in the temple of Dagon. It's not Lily, 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 but it's Samson, Samson, Samson. And then he turns to the Lord, and finally in his life, the second prayer that he prays in verse 28, then Samson prayed to the Lord, O sovereign Lord, remember me. O God, please strengthen me just once more. And let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes. Then Samson reached towards the two central pillars, which the temple stood, bracing himself against them, his right hand on the one and the left hand on the other. Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. Then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. Thus he killed many more when he died than when he lived. Then his brothers and his father's whole family went down to get him. They brought him back and buried him between Zorah and Eshtahol in the tomb of Manoah his father. He had led Israel 20 years. He had not fulfilled the work that had been given to him. He started so well but ended so badly. I love the poem, Lord of the years that are left to me, I yield them to your hands. Melt me, mould me, make me to the pattern thou hast planned. May the Lord just help us in dealing with our sexuality. May we know what it is to not just let him down. May we know what it is to have a person that's a helpmate to us. May we know what it is to help that one and to be helped all the days of our life. And may the Lord just help us each one in the pathway that's before us, that we may end the race that we've started well. And we may know what it is to be filled with the Spirit and to deal with our sexuality.
Number 92. This is a new one, perhaps for many of you. I've never sung this hymn before, and I've just learned it today, but I've been impressed with the words of it as it's related to our conference. Oh, Jesus Christ, grow thou in me, and all things else recede. My heart be daily nearer thee, from sin be daily free. Let's hear the musicians play it for us and see if we can catch on to the tune, then we'll have a go at it. Thanks.